From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's show, I'll talk with Betty Reed Soskin. At 94, she is the oldest active park ranger in the U.S. Her multifaceted life story is punctuated with poignant life lessons. During World War II, she worked as a clerk in a segregated union hall. She was also active in the civil rights movement. Nearly 10 years ago, Ms. Soskin began her full-time position as a park ranger with the National Park Service at the age of 85. Now she conducts tours explaining the park's history and purpose. She's also been celebrated as a tireless voice for ensuring the African-American wartime experience has a prominent place in our park's history. Her tours are so popular that tourists have to book months in advance, and the park has added tours to keep up with her. She joins us now to reflect on her life and her work.
I don't know where to begin because your life is so rich and so full. First of all, let me just ask, where do you get the energy?
I have no idea. Yeah. I have no idea. I must have been born with it.
Yeah. Do folk in your family live a long time?
Yes.
Yeah.
My great-grandmother lived to be 102. Uh-huh. My mother lived to be 101.
Yeah.
My father, I think he made 95.
Yeah.
So, yes. Longevity is.
Yeah. Do you have any idea what accounts for that?
No,
yeah.
I really don't. I think it's genetic, though.
Yeah, just genetics, yeah.
Because all of those people were active until they died.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So since I have time, I want to start at the beginning. You were born in Detroit.
Born in Detroit.
Okay.
I think that Isabel Wilkerson would understand my story.
Oh, yeah.
My father called a white man by his first name in New Orleans, at which point the family had to get him and my mother, who was pregnant with my sister, out of New Orleans and into Detroit in order to save his life.
Wow.
So I was only there until it was safe to return to New Orleans.
Yeah.
And so I don't remember ever being in Detroit.
Yeah.
But was in New Orleans until I was 6 years old when I went to California.
Yeah, yeah. Did you get a chance to read Isabel's book?
Yes.
You did?
Absolutely.
What did you think of that?
Absolutely. It should be a required reading for everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Are you, would you call yourself a voracious reader?
I was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. Now I'm busy rangering.
Yeah. You're busy rangering, not as much time to read.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a powerful book, though. I take your point when you said she would understand that story well.
Oh, yes.
That's quite a history. We'll get to your history in a moment, but that's quite a family history that your father and mother had to be ushered out of the city to save his life for calling a white man by his first, not out of his name, but by his first name.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you spent some of your formative years in New Orleans.
I was in New Orleans from the time I was 2 until I was about 6.
Right.
And then that was the year 1927 when the Mississippi flooded and the levees were bombed by the city fathers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And our ancestral home was in the Treme.
Right.
And of course they sacrificed the 7th and 9th wards and the Treme.
Right.
And my mother arrived in California with 3 little girls and everything we had left in a couple of cardboard suitcases.
Yeah.
But her father was here, my grandfather.
Yeah, I was about to ask why California, because you're
I was in California.
Right, right. What do you recall about those early days in California?
Oh, I remember them. It's a child of a service workers generation.
Mm-hmm.
Our fathers and our uncles were the red caps and the Pullman porters and the waiters and the cooks and the laborers and the bellboys. And our mothers were pretty much 50 cents an hour domestic servants, because that's who we were as a nation in those years.
Yeah.
And so I grew up in Oakland, California.
Yeah. How did you, as you look back on it, how did you process then being made to feel, even in California, even out west, as less than?
It was peculiar because it wasn't so much that I was feeling less than, but I came up in Oakland, California at a time when there were enough African Americans in the Bay Area to make any rules against. It's not that segregation didn't exist.
Sure, sure.
Or that bigotry didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But there were simply not enough of us. There were no white and black drinking fountains.
Mm-hmm.
There was no plate signs. So that I came up pretty much as a second-generation Californian. Mm-hmm. You know, the little girl next door was Marie Castro,
yeah.
And she was Portuguese, and her parents were bilingual, and so were mine. They spoke a patois of French out of New Orleans.
Yeah.
And so I grew up pretty much as a second-generation Californian.
Yeah. How, because this is such a rare opportunity for me and for the audience,
yeah.
And I think you'll take my question,
mm-hmm.
How would you situate the role that growing up in California specifically has played in your life?
I think there are lots of factors.
Sure, sure.
The fact that I grew up as a child before the passage of Proposition 13,
mm-hmm.
which meant that I was educated at a time before the when California's public education was
best
the envy
in the
of the world.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I grew up with a pretty rich kind of upbringing in terms of education.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that now.
Mm-hmm.
I think I must have graduated from at least 2 years of community college education.
Yeah.
And I grew up in a school that had about, I think there were 6 children of color in my graduation class, mm-hmm. in a school that's now 99% African American.
Mm.
So that those demographic changes during my lifetime have been really, really dramatic.
Yeah. What did, as a child, every child has a dream of what he or she wants to be when they grow up. What were your dreams? We'll come back to, again, to what you're doing today, but what were your dreams then?
I just wanted to grow up.
And why were you in such a hurry to grow up?
Because I saw power in being a grown-up,
yeah.
that I didn't see in being a child.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah. I think I had my whole life in a constant state of surprise, and I'm still experiencing that.
Yeah. Do you go looking for those surprises, or are these just things that happen to you?
No, it's just that I find myself at 94 still with unanswered questions,
mm-hmm.
still with my curiosity intact,
yeah.
still waiting to see what's around the next corner.
Yeah.
I'm still having first experiences at 94.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who would have believed that?
Mm-hmm. You used a phrase a moment ago that I want to go right back to and pick mm-hmm. up on, because I was just, again, in conversation about this, about how at some point in your life you have to be willing to live with unanswered questions. And for some of us, that's not easy to do. How did you get settled? I mean, the curiosity piece I get.
Yeah.
But on some fronts, you just have to learn to accept and just live with the fact that all of your questions in life are not going to be answered.
But that's been confirmed in this last decade.
Right.
I now visualize myself as an evolving person in an evolving nation, in an evolving universe.
Mm.
So that change is expected for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect those questions to ever be answered, because in my life, all the questions have led to more questions.
Mm-hmm.
So that the answers always had to step aside for the questions.
Mm.
And that's still happening for me.
Yeah. Is there a question or questions, a couple that come to mind, I don't know, you tell me, that that you're still most curious about in the world, in the universe, in your life?
Oh, I think the ultimate questions will always be,
mm-hmm.
You know, where am I going and why am I here?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are the things that I don't, I think it takes more than one lifetime to live through to find those questions.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that I'm going to have more than one lifetime.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah. Have you figured out, though, at 94, why you are here, your purpose, your calling, your vocation? Do you know what that is?
No. And I'm not sure that I want to.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would be, the answers shut down the quest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I will die still with unanswered questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not what I'm looking for.
Yeah. At this age, what is your quest?
To have lived a meaningful life, to have left a legacy, and I think that I'm doing that. I think I'm doing that without any intention with the National Park Service.
Mm-hmm.
That opportunity's been given to me. I could never have foreseen that.
Yeah.
But I have a sense only in retrospect that I am helping to shape a national park. I don't think I could have ever intended to do that, or that I'd have had the ability to do mm-hmm. that. But in retrospect, looking back on it, I can see my influences all around me. And that's, I think, that's something that, it's stunning. It's an incredible legacy.
Mm. What then is for you the joy over these almost 10 years now? Mm-hmm. What is the joy in creating, building, growing a legacy around your service in the National Park System?
It gets back to that evolutionary thing I was talking mm-hmm. about. When the parks were created, around the John Muir, Teddy Roosevelt, even Albright and Mather and all mm-hmm. those people who originally, it was in the model of the armed forces.
Mm-hmm.
It moved in, it was of course an environmental thing at first. It moved into a new phase under Franklin Roosevelt and became more involved with wildlife and mm-hmm. preservation and conservation. I happened to come into the national parks at a place where an awareness had begun to grow into the National Park Service that though every taxpayer in the nation was funding the creation and the development and the maintenance of this incredible system of parks,
mm-hmm.
it was only the people with the financial resources and the leisure time who could visit them.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came in, it was after there began to see the need for creating urban parks.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Now, more of my conversation with the oldest active park ranger, Betty Reed Soskin.
The park that I'm now involved with is far from that original concept.
Mm-hmm.
But we can now revisit through this 411 units of the park system almost any era in history. The heroic places and the contemplative places and the scenic wonders and the shameful places
mm.
and the painful places. There's a visitor center at the foot of mm. Pettus Bridge
mm-hmm.
in Selma, at the grave of Martin Luther King, at Manzanar, the Japanese-American internment. And there are portions of this history that we have never really processed. And through this system of national parks, it's possible for us to go back and revisit that history in order to own it, in order to process it, in order to begin to forgive ourselves,
mm.
and over time to move into a more compassionate future. And that is the gift, for me, of the current system of national parks.
Mm.
And that's the part that I'm involved in.
And how do you process, then, the role that you get to play in that regard as both a woman,
yeah.
given how this country has maltreated women
yeah.
since its founding, and as a person of color? You play a unique role in that conversation.
I do. And there's something that I'm very aware of,
mm-hmm.
and that's that the National Park Service and its consciousness that there are not nearly as many African Americans visiting the national parks as there should be,
mm-hmm.
and my sense that how can I put this? That if the National Park Service over time improves the demographics in its hiring policies,
mm-hmm.
that if that happens, we will find our way into the park.
Mm-hmm.
That those parks are visited by the middle class. And the more we African Americans move into the middle class, mm-hmm. the more we will move into the park system. Mm-hmm. And that we've got to be sure that we're making the space for middle class creation. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I am in the parks. Yeah. I find that my voice is amplified by my role. I appear in a tiny theater, 48 mm-hmm. seats, mm-hmm. three to five times a week, and I get to tell my story to an audience that's hungry for those conversations. Mm. And it's a privilege.
Yeah. How have you, I'm going all the way back now to your mom and daddy being run out of town.
Yeah.
To all that you endured here in California. How have you sustained your hope? And I ask that because listening to your story, I could think of any number of reasons why you could be bitter if you wanted to be. How have you sustained your hope these 94 years?
Oh, it wavers. Mm. It's strong at some points. It weakens. It has to be reinforced. I've fortunately always been able to recover, but I have had some of the highest of highs and some of the lowest of lows yeah. of almost anyone. At this point in life, I'm feeling powerful, but that hasn't always been true. Mm-hmm. As a woman, I came very late to feminism because the men in my life were suffering from the same kinds of deprivation that the women were. And so that layer mm-hmm. was hard to get to. I couldn't get to the kinds of oppression because I didn't sense my oppression coming from the males in my life. And so, and I think that I hold that in common with other black women, that now I'm having a greater sense of my empowerment. And I'm having it both as a woman and as a ranger and as an American. Mm-hmm. But that comes from lots and lots of experiences over lots and lots of time.
Yeah. What do you say to people? And this is the question I'm asking in part for me, mm-hmm. as well as I suspect for some in the audience. My honest confession there. What do you say to people who are afraid of getting old? That there's something about growing more chronologically gifted that scares some of us. You seem so well adjusted to it.
I don't know. I think that maybe part of what's happened with me, because I realize I've my profile in the world has grown over the past years mm-hmm. since I've been with the National Park Service. But I think part of that is due to the fact that maybe my life offers an alternative to aging. Obviously, I'm not Botoxed and I'm not, you know, haven't had any plastic surgery. I mean, all of that. Mm-hmm. And maybe the fact that I am growing older naturally has singled me out because I'm aware that I attract attention by my physical nature. And I don't take credit for that because it's genetic. I come from a long line of people who have lived a long years. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm not a part of the youth culture. Mm-hmm. I've never feared aging. Maybe it's easy because I've never really looked my age. Mm-hmm. But no, age has never been a threat to me. Mm-hmm. There's a natural quality to my mortality is something I fully expect and am ready for. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what it is. Mm-hmm. I know that I'm probably in my last decade, that I choose to use it well, I think maybe the reason I'm comfortable in it. Mm. Because a day, there's not a day that passes that I don't have a sense of having lived it meaningfully.
And yet I also sense that along with that, you wake up every day with a particular and peculiar purpose.
Yes.
For your life.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. We talked about your park service, but I also know that you're in the record store business as well. And have been for many years. Tell me about the record store.
Yeah.
Well, Mel and I, my husband, who is now long dead, because of the Second World War period, Mel volunteered. He was in his senior year at the University of San Francisco, playing left halfback for the San Francisco Dons, and went off when war was declared, Second World War, and volunteered to join the armed forces and found himself in the Navy where he could only cook. Because at that time, that's all a black man could do. He refused. And he found himself 3 days later on a train for home because they gave him mustering out pay and a honorable discharge and told him that they didn't doubt that he would make a good sailor, but they couldn't afford to put a man who was a natural leader of men in with men who might be easily led because it would spell victory at sea. And he came home feeling ashamed because he felt that he'd failed his country. He went to his grave, never sharing that story. At the same time, I was experiencing that same thing. We had both grown up in California, so that neither of us were prepared for what we were dealing with. Because neither of us wanted to ever work for white folks again, we went into business. Opened up a little record shop in our garage of our little duplex in Berkeley. Used orange crates to hold the records and a cigar box to hold the cash register. And went into business. That business is still there. It's 70 years old. And my youngest son, David, is now the provider. But it became an institution in that neighborhood. It was a springboard for everything that happened beyond that. Mm-hmm. So, those were great years.
Yeah. What kind of music do you sell in the record store?
Now we sell gospel music. At that time, it was blues and jazz and all kinds of things, whatever was happening, because of the great migration of black people came out here, bringing their culture with them. They couldn't find what was called then race music, race records. And so we were supplying those, and that's when we became record owners, record shoppers.
Since we're talking about music, I read a story in preparing for our conversation about an encounter you had with the Duke one night, about Duke Ellington. I can't imagine that hearing about it isn't going to be as exciting as my reading about it. Tell me about the night at Grace Cathedral.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the occasion was, but my husband came up with tickets to the Jazz Mass, the first at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. And it was an amazing event. I think the high point for me was probably watching Bunny Briggs dancing across the altar, in front of the altar. And I in fact, that is available on YouTube. And I've downloaded it because it still brings back those memories. And also, that was the time that Come Sunday was introduced with Joy Sherrill. That was, it's still the high point of my life.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. My in-depth conversation with America's oldest National Park Service ranger, Betty Reed Soskin, continues.
What role has music, aside from owning a record store, what role has music played in your life?
Music played a very dramatic role in my life. There was a period when my daughter was about three, when the problem of trying to adjust as a suburban housewife, that was all in a white area. We were the only black family. And trying to adapt to an irrational world caused me to go off the deep end. I became suicidal.
I actually
went into a mental break. Coming back, the reason I'm saying that is that coming back from that, I was treated by an incredible Jungian psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. I was outpatient. But I began to write music. I didn't write anything that required more than about 10 or 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. I thought I was remembering music, the other people's music, and learned in the process that I was really creating music. Mm. And began to, I think there was a time when I could sing an hour's program, all with original material, all autobiographical. And I learned finally to not consider that as symptoms of a mental break, but that there was an artist Betty that was coming through. Mm-hmm. And because I was in the care of a very fine professional, I was able to accept that. I learned to live with my insanity. Mm-hmm. Because I think that that's what was required. Mm-hmm. That to be sane in an insane world is impossible. And that I began to learn that my sanity was in my own control. But that was music that saved my life. Mm. Still does. Yeah. But now as not as a participant, but as a viewer. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I know you're looking shocked. No,
I'm not shocked. I am shocked.
Yeah.
I'm shocked because shocked is the wrong word. I am. Mm-hmm. I'm overjoyed. Yeah. I live for this. I live for rich dialogue. I live for this kind of empowering conversation. I wish I could do this with every guest I have on this program. And I always learn something every time I talk to people. There's always a takeaway, but there's just so much. Ooh, so much richness coming out of you. I hear your point about trying to be sane in an insane world. And I think the question, there's so many questions I could ask out of that. So I wasn't shocked. I was just trying to figure out what question I was going to ask first, because there's so many things that you've just said that I want to want you to unpack for me. I guess I want to start with this. What have you learned in these 94 years about how to live with pressure? And you don't make it to 94 if you don't learn how.
It's true.
How do you?
And I'm not sure. I think I'm not a list maker. I've never been. I'm not a planner. As I say, I think I've lived my life in a constant state of surprise. Mm-hmm. But I've always been open to the next adventure. Mm-hmm. And I think that in all of those decades, over all of those decades, I had been contemporary to the times I was living in. Mm. I was activist during the 60s at the national level. I have protested the war. I've done everything as it came to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that the fact that I remained contemporary and that I am still contemporary to the times I'm living in. I don't live in the past or the future. My life is now. Mm-hmm. And I think that that may be the key for me.
Now, here's the trick, though. I want you to tell me how you do this. The trick, it seems to me, is to be contemporary to the times that you live in, but to maintain a certain constancy. That is to say, you want to be who you are anywhere you are, and wherever you are, whenever you are. How do you balance that?
Let me give you an example
of that. Constancy,
On January 20th of 2009, I was a seated guest on the Capitol Mall with a picture of my great-grandmother in my breast pocket. My great-grandmother was born into slavery in 1846. She was enslaved until she was 19. Freed by the Emancipation Proclamation. Married George Allen, who was a corporal in the Louisiana State Colored Troops. And here we were, the two of us, sitting in a metal chair on the Capitol Mall, witnessing the inauguration of America's first African-American president in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial, mm-hmm. whose life was contemporary with the life of my great-grandmother. Mm. If that doesn't make your... That's how fast the time goes. Mm-hmm. That's how fast the time goes. And it occurred to me some months ago, recently, I sat up in bed one night, I don't know what I was dreaming, but it occurred to me that if I could make a template of those lives from my great-grandmother's birth in 1846 to my still being here at 94, but move it forward about 100 years, that what looms into view is the fact that those of us on the planet right now, by what we do or fail to do in the next few years, might well determine whether or not our grandchildren inherit a livable planet. Because that's how fast the time goes.
And what either, you tell me, what either makes you hopeful about that proposition or scares the dickens out of you about that proposition?
Because we have seen many, many years, the world has seen many, many times. The only difference now is that we know, we pretty much scientifically can predict the future, which couldn't be seen by other times. Mm-hmm. But we have lived, the world has lived through many, many such periods, the Middle Ages, the plague, I mean, all the sort of things. Mm-hmm. I think that the answers are possible for us, that there are enough people who are aware, who are going to see that the science gets respected, mm-hmm. and gets its due. I think it's not going to happen for me because I'm not going to live to see it. But I think that my children and my grandchildren are going to be living in a time of tremendous social change, mm-hmm. and that's out there. And so I am hopeful, I really mm-hmm. do. I see life as an upward spiral, and that mm-hmm. we keep going up and touching the same places at a higher level. Mm-hmm. That explains my great-grandmother's slavery and my still being here as a park ranger for a national agency. Mm-hmm. We're up that mm-hmm. ladder. And that nothing can prevent change. Change is irresistible.
Yeah. Again, so many questions here. You have referenced your family. And it's pretty obvious to me that you have a pretty decent understanding of your family tree, pretty mm-hmm. decent understanding of your family history.
I do.
What, and so many of our people do not. I think a lot of us started to get curious about that on the other side of Roots, the epic TV series, Alex Haley. But so many of us still don't have that sort of connection to our genealogy. How has being informed of your roots informed the routes that you have taken?
That's so much so. I started about 10 years ago doing my family history, and that is
just,
so
just,
possible.
Just 10 years ago, at 85?
Yeah.
Wow.
And traced my mother's family back to 1641 from Loudun, France, the Cajuns who came over. My father's family from 1500s, mm-hmm. The Charbonnets in New Orleans. I am so aware, in fact, that the reason I started doing the family history was because I couldn't trace the women because their names change and they get lost in history. Mm-hmm. And I started blogging online because I wanted to leave the record of my life for my own kids. Mm-hmm. I am so aware that I am a part of a continuum. And that's why mortality is, I'm at home with it. Mm-hmm. Because I see that as being a progression, mm. and that I'm a piece of that. I'm in a long line. There's a rightness about it.
What do you make of the way that technology has just changed in your lifetime?
Oh my God!
Yeah.
I have been blogging since 2003.
Yeah.
And technology and roboticism and mechanization. I mean, the world has grown so. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say that I have a sense of having grown with it. I'm aware of that. But, you know, technology is still, you know, it's the most exciting thing that could be.
Some people your age and even younger are afraid of technology. They're technophobes.
Waiting to get my driverless car. Yeah. Because that's going to give me my independence back. Yeah. Because I have only recently given up driving because my sight is failing.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah. If Google's listening.
Yeah. You want the driverless car.
Yes.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley, and now for the conclusion of our conversation with Ranger Betty Reed Soskin.
Tell me about your day job. We again got into some of this in our first conversation, but when I come to the park, of course I gotta get on a wait list just to see you.
Yes.
Because I know it's a long list, just a month's list.
No, it's not.
Yeah. I checked the other day. You just can't roll up tomorrow and see you. No. It doesn't quite work that way. But when I get to the park, and when I get to hang out with you and see what you do, what's it like? Take me through what visitors to the park get a chance to learn from you.
Okay. They get to learn from me the magic that happened in Richmond that's completely forgotten. Mm-hmm. For instance, Kaiser had four shipyards there during the war. Kaiser, a man who had never built a ship, he was a cement contractor. In fact, he dropped out of school 13, eighth grade, mm-hmm. came there after having completed Hoover Dam and Grand Coulee. The man with great self-confidence. He simply knew he could build ships if he introduced the mass production techniques that Henry Ford had introduced into auto manufacturing. Mm-hmm. He did that. He not only knew what he needed, he only needed enough hands. He didn't care who they were attached to or what color they were, and nothing that I ever read about him would suggest that he was a social reformer. Mm-hmm. He knew where the greatest pool of available labor lay, and that was in the five southern states of Mississippi, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas, and Louisiana. He brought a workforce of 98,000 black and white southerners into Richmond, a city with a population of 23,000, into his four Kaiser shipyards. With no time for diversity training and focus groups, they had to go with the broken system and together, behind a man who referred to the bow of the ship as a pointy end, mm-hmm. they built 747 ships in 3 years and 8 months. 747 mm-hmm. ships in 3 years and 8 months. And therefore, by outproducing the enemy, helped to turn the course of the war around. And that's the story of Richmond, California. Mm-hmm. And that's the story that I share. And it came about because of the acceleration of social change brought on by that day-to-day negotiating, mm-hmm. because there was no time to take on the broken system. Mm-hmm. They were all living under the common threat of fascist domination. Mm-hmm. They actually sped up in the greater Bay Area social change so that to this day it still radiates out of the greater Bay Area into the rest of the nation.
Yeah.
That's enough to build a park around.
Yeah.
And that's what I do.
I gotta come see you.
You really do.
I'm itching now to get to your tutorial. What does that story from so many years ago say to you about the capacity of a common humanity in the most multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic America ever?
You know, when I hear words like "Make America Great Again," it has never been greater for me than it is now. Mm-hmm. And I just hope to goodness that through this great gift, as Ken Burns was right, that this is America's greatest gift to itself. Mm-hmm. that we can use these national parks in order to go back and revisit the past that we've never processed. And I think that that is exactly what needs to have happened, and that therein lies the hope, mm-hmm. because I think it will make of us the democracy that we have always dreamed ourselves to be, but mm-hmm. have never really reached. Mm.
If you are the person that I think you are, then it's not just that people are learning from you. You are clearly taking something from them.
Oh, yes.
What do you take from the people that you get a chance to talk to on these tours?
I can, there's something that I have to have in order to be able to do my work, mm-hmm. and that's that all the lights have to be turned up in the theater. Mm-hmm. There's no spotlights, but all the lights, because I have to see
the faces yeah.
of the people.
Right.
I'm not a good radio person. Mm-hmm. I have to see the people. Mm-hmm. I can see the lights go on in those faces. I can see the lights go on behind those eyes. Mm-hmm. I can see it. And there's something magical that happens, and I don't understand what it is. Mm-hmm. I only know that it is. And in that hour-long presentation, because we show a film, a 15-minute film, and then I put the African-American perspective into that history in about a half-hour talk. But something magical happens. I don't know what that is, but I do know that it does happen. Mm. And I can see it. I can see it. And I take it away. Each time I do a program, I walk out of there high. Mm-hmm. I'm more and more convinced that there's only one life and that we're all sharing it. And that becomes obvious to me during those times.
Mm. You're 94 now. You decided to do this almost a decade ago mm-hmm. at 85. What was happening at 85 that steered you in this direction?
I sensed that I was involved in something larger than myself. And that I didn't know where it was going to lead, but that this is the way I wanted to spend my last decade, mm-hmm. because I was so aware that this was going to be the last. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. A lot of phrases. How do you feel about, what do you feel about, how do you process, do you even consider the legacy that you are leaving? You're at that stage in your life now where I would think that, given that you've a couple of times now made it clear that you know that
yeah.
you're nearing
yes.
the end of your life, are you okay with that?
Yeah.
How do you process what your contribution has been?
That's a big question. I don't really know, except that I really have become a part of the whole, and whatever that whole is, I'm embedded in life with others, and my connectedness is being expressed through my work at this point, and that work is very important to me. I know that when I walk out on the streets in that uniform, that every little child of color is getting a chance at a career choice that they might not have had they not seen me in that uniform. Mm. So I'm announcing a career option mm-hmm. Without doing anything. And I think that that's what my life is now. Mm-hmm. It isn't what I do, it's what I am. And I don't even know what I mean by that. And I don't think I have to know.
Hmm. And can I just tell you how cute you look in that uniform? I never seen a better looking park ranger. That hat, that outfit. Do you like the uniform?
I love it.
It looks good. It looks good on you.
I love it.
You make it look good. It's just
No.
When the first picture I saw, I said, wow, she really, that uniform works for you.
Yeah. It's amazing.
How do you, my time is almost up. How does your family, you mentioned your son, David, who runs the record store. How does your family process all of this?
My family, you know, just what's she doing now?
No. What's she doing now?
I think they're proud of me. We're a very close family.
I assume that means something to you.
Every,
I can only speak for myself, and I think for most black men, that we all want to make our mamas proud. But it's a little different, though, to hear you say that your kids are even proud of you.
But we're proud of each other. We're a very close family.
What have you learned about the importance of the value of family? I'll close on that note.
It gives identity, and I know who I am because of them. I know that I've produced life, and that maybe ultimately was my job. And I think that does it.
I just tell you, I have a lot of great guests on this program, but this has just been this has been good for my soul.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Honored to have you on.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.